All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. So what's going on? I got Bo and Yang on the show today. What a treat that was. We've been trying to get this talk together for a while. You know him. He's a cast member on Saturday Night Live. He's also been in Wicked, Bros, and Dicks, the musical, which was a fucking crass, beautiful piece of work. He's nominated at the Emmys this year for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series, and it was just a very classic kind of episode. Classic kind of engagement and talk that is what makes this show compelling to me for all these years, and I'm sure compelling to you. I know that a lot of the stuff I've been talking about out there in the world and a lot of the clips from my special have kind of taken off. And between us, I mean, me and you, my audience, I've been talking about this shit for over a decade. And I kind of keep it here with us. And making the rounds at podcasts, it's just, I don't know why. You know, I feel you get to a certain age where zero fucks are given, but also it's like someone's got to fucking say something. And the truth is, like, I don't know that I see myself as a courageous person, because it's hard to put yourself out there like that and then sort of see what happens. It's scary and it's a little overwhelming. But it's not some sort of act of courage in my mind. It's just, I'm just the kind of person that's asked to speak their mind because I live in it. I live in my mind. I live in the world and my mind processes that. And then I have to talk about it somewhere with different degrees of aggravation. But certainly in the climate we're in now, I just couldn't help myself. And a lot of times I don't necessarily say exactly what I mean, because I just don't want to shoulder the burden of that. But I always get to a point in most situations where I'm going to unload. And if it's not personal or based in spite, then I have to accept it as the way I see things, as a judgment or a piece of criticism or just what I believe. And what gives me the right to do that? Me. Who am I to judge? Me. I mean, who else is there? How diplomatic do you have to fucking be? You know, because you're in the same business or you don't want to hurt someone's feelings, yada, yada. And eventually, if it's the right day and I'm sitting behind a mic and it's not mine and, you know, I'm going to pop off, I'm going to pop off. But it's not going to be unconsidered. And, you know, the pushback from people that do not like your point of view. The pushback from, there's a lot of these debate points that, you know, right-wing zombies and reactors use. You know, they use, well, listen to this old guy, cranky old guy, listen to the bitter guy, listen to the cuck. The idea that guys in their 20s who have zero game and can count the number of times they've been laid on one hand, or the hand in their mind, or they only fuck that hand, calling me a cuck in its basic definition is fucking hilarious. No game. Just guys out there trolling around looking for their fascist fuck doll with a mouth that looks like it's been hit and covered with gloss and you know, some sort of blonde spectrum hair. The dream girl who doesn't talk. They fantasize about it all the time, but usually, again, it's that hand. If you don't have a count, you got the hand. But nonetheless, I don't want to drift on that. So look, folks, this is an ad by BetterHelp. The idea of getting advice online seems overwhelming. There's a lot of information out there. Some of it's good, a lot of it's bad or just plain made up. And that gets even harder when you're trying to get advice about wellness and mental health. But BetterHelp is an online solution where you not only get great advice for dealing with your mental health, you get person-to-person assistance and real-world solutions. That's the stuff you need to break through the online noise. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of experience. One thing I've learned by going to therapy is that you know when you need it. After you spend enough time with a therapist, you can be a better judge of yourself and your needs. BetterHelp is a great way to get you started on that path. With over 35,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served more than 5 million people globally. Talk it out with BetterHelp. WTF listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/WTF. That's BetterHelp.com/WTF. And look, I know, you know, my problems are not necessarily that interesting or even that bad. Okay, I get that. And I get a lot of my issues are my own and reactions to things. I get all of that. I mean, I just talked to an old buddy I hadn't seen in about a year. Had a massive heart attack, my age. And just sitting with him and talking through, you know, that journey of getting to the hospital in the nick of time, getting the stent put in. I mean, that's real fucking scary, real fucking hard stuff. Life at this age. I talked to another buddy of mine I hadn't seen in a year, had a complete manic break, ended up institutionalized, diagnosed bipolar, got out, trying to level off on some medicine so he can function, and he's doing it. And oddly, with that guy, I'm like, why isn't this guy texting me back? Why is he fucking, you know, avoiding me or whatever? And then you find out, like, oh my God, dude. Well, I'm glad you're all right. That's life. You got to sit down with your friends occasionally, especially the ones you haven't talked to in a while, and you're sitting there thinking they're an asshole for not getting back to you. Who the hell knows what they're going through? These two guys I hadn't talked to in a long time. I started thinking about them, and then out of nowhere, one of them texted me. I'm like, that must be kismet, coincidence, mystical, God's hand, whatever you want to say, however you want to frame it. That guy was in trouble. He's okay. They're both okay. And it gets me into the present. And I had 26 years sober on Saturday. Jesus, being grateful for what you have is a big deal. Being humble and trying to be human, as hard as that can be, to be a decent human, especially when you're a flawed motherfucker, hard. And God knows I've had my struggles, and God knows I've made mistakes, and God knows that ultimately I try to show up and do the right thing as best I can in the shadow of my codependency and my alcoholism and addiction. But, you know, I have a path that I can walk with that. And I've been walking it for better or worse, sometimes all in, sometimes not in at all, but aware for 26 years. And I know that sounds daunting, but on some level, at this age, the years are going by more quickly, and all of a sudden you're at another benchmark, another year of sobriety. And I guess I do want to say, because I field a lot of emails and I talk to a lot of people, and I've talked about it here candidly, that the idea of being sober, if you have the bug or you just can't see it because you do not believe life would be fulfilling or interesting or exciting without whatever you do, whatever you lean on, whatever you can't stop, I will tell you from my experience, that's a lie. Actually, things get even crazier once you get sober for a good few years. You know, you'll know a crazy you don't even have any experience with. And that's the craziness of you arriving at you and then trying to, you know, get that into shape. Who are you as a human when you're not kind of annihilating your possibilities in that department? And look, I did it the way I did it. And I got it, you know, it was fits and starts for years with program. And eventually I locked in, and I locked in hard, and I rewired my brain. I let that program brainwash me. Because as I've heard before, my brain needed washing. I needed a template that I could work within that would make me a less selfish, less fucked up person that could take responsibility for his actions and not annihilate himself with substances or alcohol. It's all up to you. But I just want to say, without, you know, getting too much into it and not acting as a representative of the program, however you do it, do it. But just know that, you know, if you do it without support, you're going to go crazy. And you'll probably, the way that brain works, it's going to lead you right back to where you left off. And that can happen with the support. But if you're going to let yourself go crazy because you're experiencing life for the first time with some clarity and sobriety, and you're not just jumping on some other bandwagon to fill that void — bandwagon could be anything that doesn't destroy your life, or things that do, you know, a person. I guess I just want to express that it's not necessarily easy to live life sober, but it is better because you're in life. And then you just have to reckon with your heart and mind and spirit, I guess, on some level. But I will say that it's worth it. And I will say that anything I have today, including who I am, but any success or any capacity to step up and do the work of life and of art, I can do because somehow or another, I hit a point where I needed help and I got it. And I stayed in it. And no matter how hard things have gotten during that 25 years, divorces, deaths, bankruptcy, I didn't drink, didn't use drugs. Went crazy, used a lot of other things to try to keep my sanity, to, you know, little success usually, but, you know, relief is relief. But look, it's doable and it's worth it because what you gain is who you really are. So that's my gratitude pitch. That's my service pitch. And, you know, that's my sharing the hope, because you will lose the obsession to destroy yourself in, you know, fairly short time. And then you just have to live with that squirminess. But it's worth it. Even if I don't sound sober half the time, even if I don't, in terms of not being drunk, but being a little brittle, a little dry, a little angry. Well, you know, look, I choose to hold on to the character defects that define my personality if they're not too dangerous. And, you know, you can do it your way. You know, whatever you got going. So this episode is sponsored by Squarespace. We have a website that's powered by Squarespace, which has made life easier for us since we started using it more than a decade ago. With Squarespace's collection of cutting-edge design tools, anyone can build an online presence that perfectly fits their brand or their business. Squarespace gives you everything you need to offer services on your site and get paid. Plus, streamline your workflow with built-in appointment scheduling and email marketing tools. And with Squarespace's Blueprint AI feature, you get a website builder that helps you create a fully customized site within minutes. Choose whatever features you want to get the most out of your site, just like we do with WTFpod.com. Check out squarespace.com/WTF for a free trial, and then use offer code WTF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/WTF, offer code WTF. So I did this interview with Bowen in my hotel room in New York City a week or so ago, and it really unfolded into a beautiful thing. He's nominated for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series at this year's Emmy Awards, and this is us having a sit down. Whatever I said this morning that resonated with you was after 2 weeks of profound, debilitating anxiety.
After this Albuquerque trip? Or no, just the world.
It happened in Albuquerque.
Yeah.
But to this point where I couldn't compartmentalize anything. and everything was coming in at the same intensity.
Right.
And I think a good chunk of it had to do with accepting, all right, dude, you're doing good.
Mm-hmm. But it's also coinciding with like this sun setting.
Yeah.
So that is also crazy.
Yeah, I can't really separate it all.
Mm-hmm.
And it just all happens at once. How do you handle it? Are you anxious?
I was on Wellbutrin.
Oh yeah. How did that go?
Not well.
What did it do to you?
I was taking it while we were shooting Wicked.
Uh-huh.
And what that was, and this is well documented, was I was flying out of...
Well documented problem, crisis.
Yeah.
I
was flying Sunday morning, first flight out of JFK on Sundays after an SNL.
Right. So you're wasted.
I was well behaved.
Were you tired?
Just tired. Yeah. And I would fly back and forth from London to New York, Sunday to Tuesday, basically.
Yeah.
Or Sunday to Wednesday. I'd have 2 days of shooting in London, and then I would fly back and do the show. And, you know,
it was like 7 hours?
7 hours each way.
Yeah.
I thought I could hack it.
Yeah.
With like nootropics and like Red Bull or Celsius or whatever. I thought I could chemically get ahead of it.
Right, right.
And cut it and full breakdown.
How'd that manifest?
Just waking up and feeling like I didn't know who I was, where I was, why I was there, like why, And then I think I had to like I like linked it back to the Wellbutrin, and I was like, okay, it's not anxiety, but it exists. That is like a thrum, but I think the main thing was depression, and so then we switched to Lexapro.
How's that working?
I love it.
Really?
And I'm on the lowest dose, and I had to split the lowest dose, and I was only taking half pills, and now I've bumped it up to just one cute little capsule.
And it didn't mute anything?
I don't think so.
There was no adjustment?
There was an adjustment. Oh, no, there was a huge adjustment. Those first 2 weeks were those are no fucking joke, and I don't understand how anyone surmounts that and they stick with it. The 2 weeks.
Huh. What did it do?
I'm
asking for a friend.
Really? Okay. I was so tired, just languorous. This is my thing. I use a lot of SAT words. I'm so sorry. This is a product of like,
no, I like it.
My parents getting me on it, like when I was like 12.
Yeah.
They're like, you're going to start studying for the SATs now.
Yeah. Yeah. We want you ready by 14.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was so tired.
Huh.
And then I think like through the morass, you come out the other side and you're like, oh, I feel great.
Really? Just so one day you're like, okay.
Yeah.
Huh.
Kind of. I think you'd love it.
Huh.
But haven't I heard you talk about Prozac though?
Well, that was for my cat.
That was the cat.
And I hadn't done it in a long time, but like, I still believe that through radical self-acceptance that I can find
which it seems like you've arrived at.
I'm close.
Yeah.
But it's fleeting. You know, like I have 4 days of it in New York because I'm getting a lot of attention.
Yeah.
But when I get home, I'm like,
Mark.
What?
Oh, I was texting Sarah Sherman and A.D. Bryant before this.
Yeah.
Like yesterday and the days leading up to this.
About what?
I was just like, I'm so excited to do this. And your episodes are so great with him. And isn't he the best? And they were like, he's the best. And... just lots of feelings of love and joy and warmth towards you.
Oh.
And so we're there as a resource for you if you ever need.
Well, thank you.
If like off the press schedule you want like validation, we will be. You can avail yourself.
Yeah. Us. Well, that's one thing I realized too about guys who or just people who operate at the level you're operating at within show business. I think that whatever my anxiety or whatever I experienced, I think it's some sort of self-protection of me getting there.
Yeah.
That because like there was, it's clearly no way, it's taken me a long time to frame that, like even the SNL experience or whatever.
Yes.
It's like, I wasn't ready for that. I mean, if you're not ready for something and you get an opportunity, you're just going to break apart.
I don't know that I'm ever, I don't, I've never thought I'm ready for anything.
Okay. So how's it, the entry into it?
Crazy.
Right.
Crazy.
Right.
I mean, like me getting SNL at least getting moved to cast from the writers, from the writing job was, I think the craziest experience I've ever had in my life. And just probably traumatizing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it sounds like what you're arriving at though this week doing Seth last night.
Yeah.
Is like, is you were talking about this? It's like, oh, I've been in that room.
Yeah. Sure.
From like sure. Like I've been in that room so many times in my life.
But also not the panic of overthinking it.
Yes.
Like I've got to, you know, this has got to. What if this doesn't, you know?
I know. And I wasn't, and can I tell you? So I was not overthinking this, even though I was telling Sarah, I was like, I don't think I've ever been more nervous for something.
Come on.
No, oh, stop.
What are you talking about?
You're good at deflecting this kind of thing, but like, I think this is, it's so cool.
Yeah, it's funny because I always assume I'm more nervous than the guest.
Interesting. Really?
I feel like we're peers. You know, but like if I'm sitting across from, if certain guests don't disarm me, mm-hmm. along with me disarming them,
yeah,
it's like, you know, you're sitting across from Jessica Chastain, and I'm like, oh my God, look at her, what am I going to do?
Right.
So there, it's not debilitating, or I think I can't do it, but I'm like, all right, is this a person?
Yeah. Well, where does your ability to disarm come from if you're like, how is that? I don't know. I don't know how you square that with own.
I approach them as a person.
Okay, great.
Unless I'm overwhelmed with fanness.
Yeah.
And that's only happened a couple times.
Right.
And you can hear it.
Yeah.
I'm just sort of like, oh my God. So you're, like Anne Hathaway? What are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah. Oh, but I think the way that you and I were introduced was actually quite nice and organic and lovely. It was Lily Gladstone
yes.
We were all in Vancouver.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she had just, I think she had just hung out with you or something.
She said you were doing a movie with her,
and she was like, you know, like Bo and Mark.
Yeah,
like
okay,
you guys link
let's
up.
Do it. Yeah.
And I feel like that's the perfect kind of landing for me as a fan.
Yeah.
So that you can receive me in a way that is not like a little bit like shields up. Like, oh, who is this guy?
No, I know who you are. Isn't Lily great?
Best. I mean, she. So her and I, our thing is that we are star siblings.
Uh-huh.
Because the craziest thing that I've ever heard from someone in terms of like a cosmic sort of like spiritual connection is that she was like, "No, you're my star sibling. You're my star brother." I was like, "What does that mean?" And she was like, "My mother was pregnant with a son named August before me." And did not come to term, and so you know it was this thing that she mourned her whole life, and then one day years later she sees you on SNL, and we're watching SNL together.
Yeah,
and she goes, "That's him." She goes, "That's August. That's like Lily. That's your brother."
What?
And that was the first thing Lily told me.
Oh my God.
Betty Gladstone.
Yeah.
What a fucking legend. So, but Lily has that energy of like, she'll tell you something profoundly piercing in that way where you're like, we're connected for life. You know, like she has that effect on people.
She brings in a fully mystical element.
Yes.
That, you know, is not refutable.
No.
Because it just is.
Yes. No. It just is. You don't question it. There's no like, there's a reason why. She's had the career she's had.
Yeah.
Even before Killers, it's like, God, she's a fucking legend.
Yeah, I worked with her in that movie I did. We'll see what happens with that, but mm-hmm. she was great.
She's
just like a intense and, you know, profound presence.
But that doesn't belie her own like sense of levity. Like she's still like funny, and she's like
Yeah. So I just talked to Nora.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't heard the whole episode yet because it just came out.
It's interesting that over the years, the experience of Asian children of immigrants, that they're like, it rarely takes a different path.
I know.
But hers was easier than most.
Right. Well, Wally's great.
Her dad. Oh, you know him?
Yeah. Okay, well, I've met him only a handful of times, but like on her on the show that we did on Nora from Queens, like semi-autobiographical.
Yeah.
Like I I see her father and her family through B.D. Wong's portrayal of him. And
yeah.
Anyway, but he's, no, but like, she,
yeah, he seemed like he was really kind of integrated and
yeah.
kind of liked weird, interesting music.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And like,
he hung out at Barney's Beanery. Like,
yeah,
he's,
right.
Like, he's that kind of Asian. Like,
yeah,
like
yeah.
I didn't have that at all.
Where'd you grow up, though?
So I was born in Brisbane, and then we moved to...
Brisbane's like the worst part of Australia.
Oh, stop. I mean, it's like San Diego.
I guess, man. But when I was like, when I went there and I did a few shows,
yeah.
I had Brisbane, Melbourne, and Sydney. The Brisbane
least
gig,
favorite.
People were like, oh.
Why?
They were like, it's the most righty kind of conservative.
Sure. Totally.
So I didn't, and you're not enjoying the beach there.
You're
All
not.
I know is I got there and they had to move me to the smaller venue.
Oh, okay. Brisbane sucks. Fuck Brisbane. I don't know. I have no emotional connection there.
Yeah.
We moved when I was 6 months. As soon as I was cleared to fly, like we, like my parents.
But how'd they end up in Australia?
My dad was getting his doctorate in mining explosives engineering.
Pretty specific.
Pretty specific.
Was that his passion growing up?
Yeah. He loved that. No, he's just a nerdy guy. And I think he...
How'd they get out? What was that?
So my parents were part of the first class of Chinese youth who were able to leave the country for like advanced degrees after the Cultural Revolution. So like 85 or
so
some such.
He has memories and lived through the Cultural Revolution.
Yeah. They both, I mean, yeah, but they both do. Very different experiences. My mom was in, grew up in this city called Shenyang, which is Liaoning. Mukden, it's also called Mukden.
Yeah.
A lot of Manchurian, like there's some Manchurian lineage there. My
yeah.
dad, meanwhile, was in Inner Mongolia.
Uh-huh.
And we just went there.
I have no sense of any of that. I was
yeah.
in Beijing once.
Nice.
To do shows. I okay. don't know.
And what was the size of the venue there?
It was small and weird.
Okay.
It was for expatriates. You know, it was a show.
Sure, sure.
And they had just, that spy plane had just crashed there.
Oh!
The American spy plane. And we were told, like, you know, to stay away from that. But, like, I...
don't talk about the plane.
Yeah, don't talk about... what were you going to say?
Yeah, I don't know.
But it was kind of, like, mind-blowing and odd, you know?
Being
it,
there, yeah. It's
because
really
it's, like, for me, for an American, it was like another planet.
Of course.
I mean, what the fuck is happening here?
I know.
And I became obsessed with the Hutongs. Like,
aren't they so cool?
Yeah.
That, I love the Hutong.
Because it's the only thing that represents that in the dusty Forbidden City that they don't even seem to upkeep.
They don't upkeep, and still it's the most crowded place you've ever
But it's
been.
Literally dusty and shit, and they're just sort of like, we got to do it. You know, like,
but they don't do it.
No, but they left it.
They left
they
it.
They could have just plowed it over.
I think they put more effort into like re-embalming Mao's body like a block away.
Yeah, embalm the Forbidden City. Like,
embalm the Forbidden City.
Yeah, do something. So when I was there, I felt like the Hutongs were some sort of honest representation of how people live, sadly, in, at
Truly.
Least in that city.
Well, I think it's an honest representation of the way people lived, yeah, like probably before Mao.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, how'd your dad live?
So my dad grew up in this... mud and straw hut.
Come on.
In the grasslands, in the fields. But actually, it was like arid. And so they were like, the family was like subsistence farmers. And
what does that entail?
Just like, just you grow what you can, like canola flowers and potatoes if the weather lets it.
And you've got, they told you this whole history.
They told me the whole history. And my first trip there was when I was three. I don't really remember it, but that was when his parents were still living in this house.
In the mud and straw house?
In the mud and straw house. And this was like their last year there because my mom's side of the family had like worked it out through like all this, like they like cut through all the bureaucratic nonsense of like, because it's a whole thing to move a family out of like provincial life in China into the cities and like as they were developing. And so there's just all this like licensure and whatever the fuck. And so... like that had to happen, and my mom's side of the family helped with that. And then, you know, we moved everyone from my dad's side of the family into the city. And like, I honestly don't know if that was necessarily the right thing to do
for the grandparents.
For the grandparents, for like my dad's side, because
culture
like,
shock,
culture shock, and like they, I don't know, like
they were okay there.
In retrospect, it seemed like they were kind of happy.
Yeah,
and I think my mom would agree. But like everyone's fine now. There's no like, there's no real hardship.
Yeah,
everyone's great. It's just this is all fresh because I came back Sunday, And
where were you? You went to Mongolia?
I went to Inner Mongolia. It's a misnomer because it's the province that is south of Mongolia, okay, in China. It's not technically in Mongolia.
And you hadn't been there, but you'd been.
I'd been.
Yeah.
But the last time I went was 2016, and we still went to my dad's childhood home. So we go back, and it's like it's about to collapse, but we go, and it's cool. Like, he showed me, like, this time he showed me, like, this little closet he built through the wall. It's like literally what that looks like over there.
Yeah.
We're in Mark's Hotel. And just amazing. And
there's other people living in it?
No one's living there.
It's a monument.
It's a monument to me.
Yeah, yeah. This is where Bowen's father
this
lived.
This is where Bowen's father lived. Yeah.
It's a little plaque hand carved.
Oh, that would be fun. But I posted pictures from there of me, like, standing in, like, a t-shirt and shorts.
Yeah.
I guess I took a certain stance. Like, yeah. I don't know. I just looked like I was of that place or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And I posted it to my Instagram because I, like, worked through a firewall, and then Chinese social media picked it up, and then all the comments were like, not even expats. So it's like people in China who, and there's a contingent there. And I even texted this to Lauren. I was like, you'll be happy to know this. There's a very spirited contingent of SNL fans who are Chinese and who love the show and whatever.
What did Lauren say?
Lauren said, hilarious, the power of YouTube. just pity. But so these pictures were posted, and then it kind of, like, proliferated through Chinese social media, and then all the comments were like, oh my God, I had no idea his family was from here. And there were clips of me speaking Mandarin, and they were like, I had no idea he could speak Mandarin. And
wow.
But corollary to it was, I'd never come out to extended family. I'd never came out to anybody in China. And it's just my parents and I and my sister who are outside.
And
who are in the state.
And everyone in America.
And
who knows?
And everyone in America knows.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about them. But I got a tutor in the months leading up to the trip just to be like, hey, my Chinese is fine. I don't have the vocab to, like, explain to them, like, what I do,
right?
Like what my work particulars are,
yeah.
And, like, what my life is like, and
would that be allowed?
It's allowed. It's just not, and it's not like a. It's just a cultural thing where it's like, oh, like, why would you be that? You know?
Yeah.
Because coming out to my parents, like, the thing that they kept saying, my dad kept saying, was like, where I come from, this doesn't happen.
But what was the issue in the corollary to the...
Well, the corollary is that I had never come out to anybody in the family.
Yeah.
And I got this tutor just in case
This is just this last time you were there.
Yeah. This is just the last couple months before the trip.
In your history, you never came out. You were found out.
So this is the found out part is, like... Social media kind of, the Chinese social media kind of did it for me because all the comments were like, oh my God, look at how straight he looks. Look at, isn't that so funny? And, like, they're referencing, like, sketches from SNL where, like, we've done, like, meta takes on it where, like, I'm actually a straight person and
really?
The gay thing is an act. Yeah. Like, and so, like, they, like, were referencing that and being like, oh my God, maybe he really is straight. Ha
ha
ha.
Yeah.
And then over the week, like, my fam, like, my cousins and my uncles were like, Bowen, like, you're really blowing up, like, on these apps, and the comments are so entertaining. Oh, they're wondering where you're from, and, like, it's just, wow, that must be so fun. And, like, it was just always unsaid.
Oh, so to that part of the family, the Chinese part.
To the Chinese part of the family.
Who live in China, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
And they were like, we're seeing it on our, like, it's on our algorithms, and, oh, it's so, this is so interesting.
And they didn't say anything.
They didn't say anything. But they had to have, but they're like, if they're reading through the, they're referencing the comments, and half of the comments are, oh my God, look at him. He's usually so fruity, and look at him wearing, like, you know, a nice button down shirt or something. Like, it was really interesting. And then by the end of the trip, like, it didn't come up. But the only thing I can clock from this time is that, you know, in all my prior visits, they would just ask you, like, starting from, like, the age of 14, they'd be like, when are you getting a girlfriend? Do you have a girlfriend? Like, when are you getting married? And no one asked that either. None of that either. So,
well,
like, they know.
Right. But in light of the cultural sort of reaction to it, wouldn't that be a form of politeness and respect?
Definitely. I think I'm still not quite sure how I feel about it, but I am relieved that the conversation didn't have to happen, because even with this tutor, like, the week before the trip, she was like, okay, let's do like some role playing. Yeah. I'm going to be, and she was very, she lives in China, but she's like very attuned to like Western culture and even gay culture. Like she gets it.
Yeah.
And so, and I really looked out with her, but she was like, we're going to role play. I'm going to be your cousins and we're going to be at this big banquet hall table with like, you know, all your relatives. Cause this is just what, you know, Chinese people do.
And you're going to stand up and say, I'm gay.
you're going to do like, what a feeling from Flashdance. She was like, and I'm just going to ask you questions that they would ask. Yeah. So the first thing they would ask you is like, how much money do you make? Because that's what's important. And I was like, okay, great. I can do that. And then laundry list of things. And then finally she was like, okay. And then I'm going to ask you like, do you have a girlfriend? And then I was like, is that when I tell them? And she goes, honestly, no. And I was like, what do you mean? She was like, I don't think you should tell them. I was like, what do you mean? Like the whole point of this was so that I could like work up to telling them in Chinese like that this is who I am and this is how long I've known and whatever.
Yeah.
And she was like, how long did it take for your parents to come around? And I was like, oh, like 10 years. And she was like, exactly. Like you cannot expect them to catch up to that, like catch up to all of this information.
To just drop it on them and then, you know, expect a reaction that's going to be positive.
No way.
But it is sort of interesting that you know they know. And I would assume culturally there's plenty of gay people that they know and it's just unspoken.
Right.
And they're probably just hoping for the best. That maybe that'll heal up.
Oh, interesting.
Right. I don't know. It feels to me that even a lot of straight parents who know, that's the only way they can accept it, just by not talking.
By not talking about it.
As opposed to saying, like, what's wrong with you?
Right.
Get out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Just suck it up and maybe eventually learn how to open up or tolerate.
Yeah. My only thing, and I'm not owed this.
Yeah.
I just thought this was, like, my one shot at, like, doing it in the first place. Because they're like, what are you doing? Get out of the house. I mean, my parents didn't kick me out, but they were like, this is crazy.
Where were you when that happened?
This was in Colorado. Oh, yes. Born in Brisbane. Then we moved to Ontario and then Montreal and then Colorado.
So what's your citizenship?
Dual American-Canadian.
That's good.
Yeah.
Why are you saying it like that?
No, I'm like, yeah. Like,
oh, you're saying, like, don't be jealous of me?
No. I'm just saying, like, I'm very, I can leave. I'm good. Like, I feel good about that.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking about, like, the collective mood of, like, what it means to, like, have both. And I'm lucky.
To have an exit strategy.
To have an exit strategy.
That is, you know, in paperwork.
Right.
That
you gotta find the papers first.
Yeah. But. Well, I used to do a bit about that, like, about applying for Canadian permanent residency status, because you know I don't want to be the Jew at the border without his papers when it goes down. You know, I don't want to be standing there holding a stack of scripts that I wrote.
There's an exchange rate for that.
Yeah, like, sure. So you didn't come out. You were.
I was found out. Like my parents found out, and then that was not on my terms.
At this point, your father's established. He's working. Mm-hmm. You know, he's living the immigrant life to his full potential.
Yes.
And he believes that, you know, like, if you do what I do, you can be a success.
Yes. Like the sort of crazy, insane blemish on that dream is like, oh, having like a gay son. Like that is, and there's some cultural significance to him being the eldest of his brothers and that the son of the eldest brother, even though
you're the king.
There's this meaningful lineage that I have to sort of uphold.
Yeah.
As the son of the, like, I don't understand really how it works. Like it's all bullshit.
Yeah.
I can say.
Yeah.
As a westernized person.
It's not tribal. It's like a.
Yeah. I don't know what it is.
It's not caste, but it's
filial,
traditional, you know, kind of structures.
Yes,
ancient structures.
Yeah,
yeah.
Hegemony.
Yeah, something.
Neither of us are
anthropologists.
Anthropologists.
Yeah, yeah. But so what happens?
Well, I mean, you know, it all worked out.
Yeah,
and part
it's
of me
have to, because at some point you're like, it's got to work out. It's going to work out even if it doesn't work out. You got to live your life.
Yeah.
Unless you're fragile and, you know, collapse into yourself and fucking disappear.
which kind of happened. It happened during this whole like crash out with the Wellbutrin.
Yeah.
But anyway, I...
Different reason. So, but what does happen when they find out?
Well, Dad's an engineer. Mom used to be a doctor. They are solutions-oriented people. And so...
But they're also humanists.
Yeah. Well, they were like, we found this guy, this person in Colorado Springs, and we're going to go there. Like,
Colorado Springs, that's the heart of it.
That's the heart of it.
Focus on family.
Focus on the family, mega church, yeah. Central. And this was right after...
How gay was the guy that ran that place?
So he was... He was not super gay at first blush, but then he let something slip on the last session. And it was really amazing. And can I tell you, he was like, so this was like, it was only 8 weeks, and the ultimatum was like, I could either stay in state and live with my parents in Denver for college, or because my sister was at NYU, they were like,
yeah.
Or if you go to conversion therapy and see this guy, you can go to NYU and live with your sister. And these poor people didn't know that it's the gayest school in the country.
Yeah.
But I went, I acquiesced, and my dad and I would drive 2 hours each way to Colorado Springs. And those drives were actually like really good bonding time for us.
Feel like men?
God, I don't know. We just, we would like go to gas.
Was he being overcompensating?
No, my dad is... I don't know what is masculine about my dad more than like, I don't know, these notions of masculinity in any culture are so silly.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Yeah, I don't, I know that I don't, abide or instinctively represent most of them, but I can, there have been moments where I get it.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty broad spectrum.
Of course.
Unfortunately, the dominant spectrum now is not great.
It's not great.
Yeah.
And I'll take my dad's strain of that any day. He's just like
But the weirdest thing about the far end of the spectrum, which is dominant culturally wise, is that they're so gay.
They're so gay.
I mean, I can't when you I mean, it's like the attention to this sort of like weird anal attention to their grooming and then
it's anal, yeah.
Yeah, but I like when I see pictures of groups of like young Republican men, I'm like, come on.
I know.
Let it go. And the fact that these guys are trying to make themselves attractive to this, this fictional woman mm-hmm. that they think is going to
reject them. Yeah.
Or manifest as like these trad wives or whatever.
Right.
It's like, what are you going to do with that? I mean, like the lack of game that you can just see in all of these guys is like profound.
I know.
Well, whatever.
And one thing about gay culture,
yeah,
you don't have to have any game. As long as you have the parts that someone else likes, you're good.
Yeah.
You don't even have to have a dick. It's a lot more fun. It's a lot more fun.
Yeah, I had a professor in college that like I was sort of like he was sort of obsessed with me. And I kind of let that happen because I was so fascinated with gay culture at the time. Uh-huh. It just seemed like even though I wasn't gay, I'm like, they're really having a good time. I think I used to do a bit about that. I'd say like I think most guys are gay if you just relax.
When you
hear sort of effeminate dudes talk, uh-huh. like hi, you're like if you just let yourself do things, like why wouldn't you do that all the time?
It's great.
It's so relieving. You almost want to kind of cry and be happy all the time.
It's so double make hair in a
way. It is.
Yeah,
it is. Just let it go, man. Just relax.
Just relax. That's why I mean, like me, reading all these comments on Chinese social media about like how like usually effeminate I am. I was just kind of like I was getting a kick. I was like, yeah, like. It's the water's warm, like it's okay.
But it's weird, like if I think about it, even just talking to you now, if I'm thinking out loud, it's not really effeminate. It's mm-hmm. just a different male on the spectrum of maleness.
Totally.
It's kind of weird because I've never seen women act like gay guys.
Right.
Really? Like you don't see a woman go like she's kind of acting like a gay dude.
You should do a bit about this. That's great.
But it's true.
Uh-huh.
What feminine qualities are they talking about?
Right.
Like even the amplification or the heightening in drag.
Yes.
It's like they're not acting like women.
No, that is the thing that I want to explain to people. It's like it's not men pretending to be women. It's men doing this heightened blown out. It's like wrestling. It's like pro wrestling.
Totally.
It's just we're pro wrestling. It's like, oh, it's a heightened version of masculinity.
Yeah.
It's the flipped version of that.
Well, I think that if there are people that say it's feminine, it's that it's because their perception of what women should be is heightened.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why they're so confused and aggravated with drag. They're like, why do I feel this way?
Right.
Because she's being the kind of woman you want to meet.
Right.
Which isn't like a regular woman.
Which is, yeah, that's that is the trad wife thing.
Yeah.
And like these, and like the incels are like, I cut in earlier and said, oh, but they want to meet this woman who's going to reject them anyways, because that is kind of like the operational thing. It's like, oh, they are working themselves up to be rejected, to be turned down. So then they can like internalize this like rage at just all women. You
yeah,
know?
They're total, you know, bottoms.
They're yes, yes. And I have to say, I think it was like your RuPaul episode.
Yeah, oh god, yeah,
where
great.
I was like, I think that's one of my favorite episodes of anything.
It's mind blowing.
I love that episode much.
Yeah,
I still think about it. But yeah, I think my dad, even though he was really like brandishing like a masculinity that he allegedly like represented, I'm like, I don't see him as this like, I don't know, this like paragon of manhood. Either.
Sure. Well, it was based in tradition, which that's the most interesting thing apart about it, because, you know, a doctor and an engineer, you know, you know, but I think there's two things working, right? It's their concern for your life.
Yes.
And then the other thing is like, you know, the role a man's supposed to play in their traditional point of view.
Right.
And those override, you know, what I'm sure is, you know, a deep love.
Oh, 1,000%. And like, and in the time since, like, that is, we've all arrived at that.
Yeah.
And things are great. I just think back to the China thing, back to like this recent trip, it's like, I was talking about this today in therapy. It's like, because what my tutor was also saying, which she was like, all they care about really is like, if you're doing well and how much money you're making.
Yeah.
And which is, you know, that's not her opinion. She's just like, that's the reality. That's the cultural observation she's making. And she was like, they won't care. And I was like, okay, interesting.
Yeah.
And I can't help but kind of think, is it a conditional thing? Like, would they not be as receptive to, would they not be as okay with me being gay if I weren't doing okay? Does that make sense?
Oh, I see. Would they accept you?
Yeah. Yeah.
If they could hang your lack of success on you being gay.
Exactly. And I don't want to breach that line.
Sure.
But like, I think about that with my parents sometimes. I'm like, this would be so, cause they kept saying we were just in our unpacking of this in recent years, they were just like, we're so sorry we did that.
Oh really?
Yeah. 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 Of course. They were like, and I've talked about it enough, like in interviews and stuff, and it used to really be this red line. I was like, I don't want to talk about it anymore. But now I'm like, no. It seems like if we've really moved past it, then it's fine. But they were like, we're so sorry we did that. We were truly just so worried that that your life was going to go in a certain direction, and that you would have been like completely, I don't know, like just not okay. Like your life was going to fall apart. And I was like, okay, cool. So,
and that's also a concern that I think, you know, any
parent would have.
That's right.
Of course,
yeah,
of course.
But they couldn't unlock that then.
They couldn't unlock that then. Like, and I can't help but wonder. But this sounds so shitty as a child. But I'm like, I just have to. I have this thought experiment every now and then where I'm like, well, how would it be? Would that still be the same if success hadn't come?
Right.
You know what I mean?
But you don't say that.
I don't say it. Well, I'm saying it now on a microphone. In a microphone.
No, but.
And a microphone and a very, very, on a podcast with a big audience.
Yeah. But I don't think that's an offensive thought. But I do think it would imply that you hadn't done your side of the accepting.
Oh.
Right.
Wow. So, you're good. You're really good. Oh, Marc Maron. Oh, cool. That's, interesting.
Well, yeah, because like in order for this all to work, is you've got to let that go and you know, feel the empathy for their situation.
Yes.
So if you were to say like, well, what if?
No,
you're still looking to, you know,
No.
Yeah.
It's not. It's you're right. It's not like that.
Yeah. No, no. I mean, but the thought, of course, can be there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it doesn't serve any purpose.
It doesn't. And I don't even know what purpose it serves. I don't even know. I guess I don't know where I'm at with the greater family, like the concentric circles outside of like the immediate nuclear family of my mom and my dad and my sister are like, okay, cousins and uncles. And then like Chinese nationals, like people in China.
Well, how did it end up? I mean, you're talking about that, like when upon leaving,
My brother-in-law and I were checking in, and he was like, "How you doing? How do you feel about this trip? And are you excited to go back to New York?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm really excited." He was like, "Okay, well, your sister is sad to go, and you know, her coming back here always reminds her of when you guys would come as kids and how happy you guys were, and seeing family is always very meaningful to her and touching her." And I was like, oh, that I totally relate to that. I just think I associate those trips, even now, I associate those trips with being in the closet.
Right. Oh, right.
Because it was like, especially like once I was a teenager and when we would go back, it was always about like white lying and kind of covering. And I remember like my favorite cousin, when I was like 14, like I overheard him in another room going to my mom and my sister, like, Bowen kind of talks like a girl, doesn't he? And it crushed me.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, well then like the jig is up and it's over.
Yeah.
And like it's curtains for me. And like, it's like, I can't uphold this lie anymore. And even still.
So you have PTSD from.
Yeah. And so like, I don't have the same sort of like unabashed, like joy about going back there the way that my sister does, I guess.
Right.
And she had to like handle like three toddlers. She was stressed the fuck out. And Yang, if you're listening, I love you. I can't believe you managed that trip like that.
Yeah.
I thought you were miserable the whole time. It turns out she loved it. And it's not that I was miserable. I was just like, I understood something about those trips in total of just like, oh, these became very stressful for me at a certain point. And maybe the stress is gone now. Like the internet in China kind of did something for me.
Oh, good.
But
well,
also maybe it didn't. I don't know.
Well, I mean, that kind of stuff is hard, you know, in terms of like, I can barely go to the Comedy Cellar because I struggled so hard there when I was younger that like, it's just sort of like, it all comes back.
I
mean, that's the problem, I guess, with PTSD on some level is that, you know, it re-triggers it. So, you know, you go to the place and you regress.
Yes.
And you can feel that old you, you know, kind of taking hold.
Yeah.
And the feelings are real. What are you going to do?
And then is the inverse of that, like you going to like the Seth studio and being like, oh, like this is where.
Well, I mean, like I go to the Comedy Cellar and I think my problem is that I can't always see who I am in the world that I exist in or my skill set. Yeah. There's just something about like, it's like when you go, you know, haven't seen your parents in a long time and all of a sudden you're 12 again and acting like that.
Yeah.
There's some, that happens.
Interesting.
And I have to rise above that, you know, and just do a good set or whatever.
And you do. And you do that.
Yeah. But the question I think that we're both asking is like, is it necessary to do that? I think it might be.
I think if you're
aware.
If you're aware, if you're like
yeah.
If you've done the work on yourself as a person, like you, it's not that you should or could or won't or
I
would.
Do.
It's like you just do it. It just happens.
I think what's similar about it is that you were, you know, in that time and you know, in just as a younger comic too, you're not who you are yet.
I mean,
and that's just part of, you know, if you were gifted with, you know, the support necessary from an early age to sort of own yourself and have the freedom to do that, good for you. and go fuck yourself.
I've never met a single comedian who's
like comes from a, you know, I think you probably met more in sketch than you would in stand up.
Oh, maybe.
Because sketch is so collaborative that you kind of need to function with other people and have a little bit of an open heart to the experience.
Yeah.
Whereas with stand-up, it's just me. And, you know, I'm well-guarded. And, you know, I'm here to shield myself and make you, and entertain you with that.
But that sounds so That sounds so, I don't know, like,
well, it's just my noble point of view. Yeah, well, no, yeah, it is. Like, to be up there with your sword and armor.
Yeah, why not? I always am jealous of the stand-ups who end up at SNL, yeah. who just have
They're ones that can work with other people.
The ones that can work with other people, and then, like, Sarah's a perfect example of that. I'm like, oh, you're good. Like, you know how to work with other people. You know, she'll say that there was a learning curve, yeah. Sure, but, like, she's got that down.
I think what's great about her is that, you know, despite her journey into, you know, extreme self-expression, I think fundamentally she's like a Jewish entertainer.
She is borscht belt.
Yeah.
I think she's so many different intersections of things.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy,
she's
right?
Like, she's Fran Drescher, yeah. But she's also like, I don't know, Phyllis Diller.
Yeah,
she's
like, and Karen Finley.
Yeah, she carries, like, she has it all in her. I don't know.
Shiny person.
I'm obsessed with her.
Yeah, it's hard not to be.
Ugh.
Yeah, because there's just so much, like, she's getting away with something. And integrating a type of creativity into mainstream entertainment that rarely happens.
It never happens.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of her.
Yeah, me too. So wait, tell me about the trauma of conversion therapy, though.
Okay.
Because, like, I mean, you were self-aware enough, but you seem pretty grounded in yourself. I imagine that you weren't only because you couldn't be honest about who you were, but it seems like the foundation of your emotional existence was pretty solid.
I don't know. I still have this thing now where I'm like, oh, is the mirror, like, how many missing pieces are there? Like, because it was shattered at a certain point.
Right.
And, like, it's been, like, slow work to, like,
sure,
put it back.
Yeah, I definitely get that. And there's some pieces you're, like, kind of glad that one's gone.
But I don't know what the pieces are.
Yeah.
I don't know what the missing... I've not taken the full inventory.
How old are you?
34.
Well, you got time.
Really? Yeah. I don't think so, Mark.
It has to happen now? Yeah,
or maybe it's like when your bone density starts to go. It's like, yeah. I think it's irreversible.
Well, you mean you can never find the missing pieces?
Yeah, maybe.
You just have to accept it.
Oh, to answer your question, how gay was the conversion therapist? You know, he let it slip by the end. Well, his first thing that he asked me was, "Do you want this to be a secular experience or a Christ-centered experience?" And I was like, "Well, the fact that you're the most fucking insane illusion of choice bullshit I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah.
Well, if I say secular, I know you're going to come at it from Christ. the back end programming of that is going to be God, Jesus, and everything else.
Yeah.
So I said secular, but I was like, the entire time it was like, you're a fucking kook.
Yeah.
That
is kind of funny because he was really just assessing, you know, what his angle was.
Exactly.
And they probably have it by rote.
They have it by rote.
Yeah, because they're dealing with fundamentally lost people in a way.
Yeah.
That's so predatory and weird.
I mean, I feel for, like, I guess I'm lucky, quote unquote, that I was like 17. I feel for the people who like...
Are younger?
Are older.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, and younger, I guess. I think I was right in that Goldilocks zone.
The people that have to hang up their chaps.
You're talking about the younger people? No, the people who have to hang up their chaps.
Yeah.
And there's this thing happening now, I guess, where like people are like, it's like people who like, I don't know, it's people who like go back in the closet.
Well, I think that's fear. And I think that in light of what we're going through culturally, that, you know, I always wonder about that, you know, especially with, you know, the gay community that is, you know, had to sort of define themselves in a way that other communities really haven't through their sexuality and through their choices in order to maintain strength and identity and culture, that I wonder how many people are just sort of like, it's just easier to shut up.
Yeah. And not to go all like pronatal, but I feel like the fact that queer people don't have something necessarily like intrinsically built in terms of like an old, like connecting with like an older generation.
Yes.
Means that it's just harder to like get the connective tissue.
Well, yeah. Cause all those old Stonewall guys are really old or dead.
Yeah. And, yeah. And like everyone, and like the people who died during AIDS are dead, obviously. And like, it's just, it's hard to like, as a gay person now, it's like you have to seek it out. Like you can't, like no one, there's no brochure, there's no like.
Yeah, I remember seeing a sketch at the Aspen Comedy Festival. It must have been in the 90s, and it was the best thing I ever saw. And I don't even know what happened to John Rigi. Do you know John Rigi?
Oh, yeah.
Is he around?
Isn't he like one of Tina's guys now?
Maybe. Or, that sounds right.
Yeah.
But he did a sketch at the Aspen Comedy Festival. And the sketch was, it was this generational gay couple sketch.
Uh-huh.
You had this younger sort of, you know, Dockers wearing khaki, you know, passing, you know, kind of new conservative-ish gay couple.
Sure.
You know, maintaining appearances. And they invite this older couple over to dinner and they show up, you know, full leather, you know, just, you know, kind of like dancing around.
Yeah.
And the culture clash between the two generations was hilarious.
Yes.
And very specific. And I think it's sort of what we're talking about.
Right.
But you're good with your parents. Yeah. And the trauma from the conversion therapy did not stick because you have a sense of humor.
And
you must have known, you know, 2 days in, you're like, this isn't going to work.
I knew 2 days in it wasn't going to work. Although this, I mean, going to NYU, like, I did go back in the closet for a year, and it was just as like a little experiment. And I was like, if everyone reinvents themselves in college anyway, I think perfect place to do it in New York City. So I tried.
Not for that one.
I genuinely had feelings for a girl. Like, I think I'm a Kinsey 4. Uh-huh. A Kinsey scale is like 0 to 5.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you know, yeah, I could
do it.
My voice cracks.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, it was 1 year of being back in the closet. And then as soon as my sister moved from New York City, I like told everybody on the improv team. I was like, I'm gay.
Yeah.
Let's go. I think like Rachel Bloom was one of like the first people I ever came out to.
She's the right one.
She's the right one. And but yeah, the conversion therapist, just like he went into this anecdote about one of his quote unquote like past patients about like his car breaking down in San Bernardino and he had to go into a Denny's and then the waiter was making eyes at him. And then in the middle of the story, this guy, my therapist, like switches pronouns from he to I without realizing it, and he caught himself. And I was like, that was about you. You fucked that waiter. And this was like allegedly like a couple years ago. So it's like, that was the last session. And the session before that, my dad was like, can you give us like referrals for people who do this in New York? He's about to go to school in New York. And this guy's like, yeah, sure. I'll come back. I have the waiter's number. Oh God. Yeah.
But you're okay.
I guess.
But do you feel like, I mean, there is sort of this, you know, it is, you know, kind of frightening, you know, culturally, but there is this, I imagine the pressure, you know, once you reach, you know, some level of gay icon status is maybe different now.
Do you feel about me?
Yeah. Do you feel a responsibility?
Not really.
Oh, good.
I don't know.
Because I don't know how, you know, these communities of people that are vulnerable to the type of you know, violence or mm-hmm. or persecution mm-hmm. just, you know, on a cultural level. And you're two of them.
Oh, interesting.
You know, that, you know, I don't know if there's a conversation there. You know,
probably is.
Yeah. Because, you know, I just know as a liberal person, mm-hmm. you know, who speaks from that point of view, mm-hmm. You know, there is a nervousness to it.
Yeah. You're talking about in terms of the way that you present yourself?
Well, just in terms of like, you know, because they're so fucking loud and their big, you know, passion for freedom of speech just meant to be able to say shut the fuck up
right.
with more confidence.
Or just a slur that they like or
sure.
Whatever.
Yeah, it's all the same to diminish the voice of others mm-hmm. Out of intolerance and fear that, you know, you can internalize that and just be like, you know, what do I need to fucking hassle for?
Uh-huh.
I'll
tell you what I internalize in terms of like the way that I like am perceived.
Yeah.
That I'm like, okay, so perfect, and perfect example with this whole Chinese social media thing. Yeah. They're like, oh, but he's gay. And like, on by and large, we're like, ambivalent about that.
Yeah.
And then in terms of gay people, they're like, oh, but he's Asian. And
right.
and there's no I don't know, like, there's no glorifying Asianness in the gay community necessarily.
Right.
So, like, either way,
you don't get the same fetishization that you get in the straight community.
Exactly.
Are you jealous?
Aren't you jealous of my my Asian figure? Yeah, yeah. I don't know. My lithe Asianness. It doesn't play. I mean, to some people it does. There are fetishists for everything.
Sure.
But I, yeah, maybe that's the, like, it's so like mutually deleterious in a way that I'm like, okay, I don't have to worry about this.
Yeah.
I really generally don't care.
Oh, good.
And I think people, I think I'm like just the right amount of disliked.
Yeah.
And just the right amount of like, oh, well, we don't really care for him. Like, we don't care about him or right. what he says.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's good if you can, you know, hold that space in that, you know, the hate isn't so profound that, yeah. you know, it makes you, you know, frightened or sad.
No.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
And so you can just kind of do what you do. And, you know, you got your space and, you know, all right.
Yeah.
I'm just going to be me, finally.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what that's like. It seems like we're both, I think you are in this, because this week is so big.
Yeah.
I appreciate that you're sort of imparting this on me.
Uh-huh. Oh,
like, I feel like that's where you're at.
Yeah, yeah. There is something happening.
I love it.
That has to do with a lot of things, you know, age being one of them. Uh-huh. But, you know, because you do get this point, it's like, dude, how long are you going to do this shit to yourself?
Uh-huh.
You know, like, time's running out, buddy.
Yeah.
You know, you better just, you know, because it's all fear, right? Really.
Right.
So, like, what are you afraid of? And if you really track that stuff, it's like, well, when I was 7, you know. So, all right, so now you're 61.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you can give that kid a break.
Totally. You totally can.
Yeah.
I don't think you need the Lexapro.
Good. I've been pushing back against that for a long time. I'm on some other stuff that I don't think is working, but the doctor told me it probably wouldn't.
Oh.
I'm on this Buspirone for anxiety.
Okay.
And which is a more specific kind of dopamine reuptake thing.
Yeah,
but it's
not
a total SSRI.
Got it.
He literally said to me, he said, this usually doesn't work for people. I'm like, that sounds like the perfect medicine for me. So if I think it's working, then that's great. And if it's not working, then, you know, not so good, but whatever. I'm familiar with that.
It's like a meta placebo. That's awesome.
Yeah. Can be. Exactly. It could go either way.
Low efficacy, meta placebo.
Yeah. So what, so how's it at SNL now? Everything good?
I think so. I mean, I hope we're on the air.
Why wouldn't you be?
After this Colbert shit?
Well, you're at NBC.
Yeah, you're right. There's no, but like, if they decide to merge out of nowhere, I don't know.
Yeah, well, that could happen to anybody, I guess.
That's true.
But it does seem like, you know, it's in this current media landscape that it doesn't seem like SNL has to make an effort to create a clip economy. Like, it's the show's sure. designed for that.
Totally. There's no, yeah, it doesn't have to change anything about itself.
Yeah.
But, you know, I got dinner with fantastic writer Will Steven.
Yeah.
And we were talking about this. We were like, okay, like, what's the vibe going to be going back? And, like, when we were both just talking about, we were talking about James, Austin Johnson. We were like, should he be worried at all? Like, just all it takes is for Trump
That's
to say
right.
one thing about him.
Well, you just got to, you know, kind of get some fortitude.
Sure. I just think that guy is
sweet
James.
Guy. The best.
The most fucking talented.
Yeah.
He's one of the best to ever do it.
Yeah.
And he doesn't get that credit enough.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I think he should be able to spread his wings and do whatever he wants on that show.
But James is like, his story is fucking tremendous.
It's tremendous. That's
the
a great
Christian
word.
Entertainment.
It's you know, so
it's
fun.
He's so grounded in something that is, you know, truly his.
Yeah.
That came out of struggle.
Yes.
Right. Same with you.
Yeah.
I mean, when you got to really fight for your autonomy
uh-huh.
from, you know,
from Colorado Springs.
Yeah.
yeah.
Dogmatic restrictions.
Uh huh.
It's you know, when you finally win that fight, you're like, oh my god.
I know.
It must be the best.
He's just. He can, like, He's a gorgeous singer.
The Dylan thing is the best.
The Dylan thing is the best. He's such a good actor, just on just like on a baseline level. Sure.
And
I'm
the
like,
way he improvises within Trump, you know, on the when on the old videos he used to do, just walking.
So good. On Beyond the Sidewalk.
It's crazy. So it's just good. So crazy. Because you could tell it's like, it was just generating.
He's in the pocket. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
So anyway, we were just talking about him. It's like, anyway, I don't want to like engender any sort of fear on anyone's behalf, but it's just like, I just think I'm interested to see what the show will be like.
Well, it seems like he's, you know, that this is weird when you have to talk about a president like this, that his form of micromanaging is being offended by, you know, comedians.
Yeah. Right.
And you just don't know where it's going to land and for how long.
Of course.
But, you know, he had an axe to grind with Alec Baldwin that preceded.
Yeah, totally.
You know, SNL. Like, that guy was always up his ass for whatever reason.
Of course.
And I think now it seems like he's not paying a lot of attention to SNL.
Right.
Because he doesn't,
you know, he doesn't feel like he needs to.
And there's not someone there that he's like, you know, fuck that guy. You know,
totally.
But also that scares me too. Like this South Park thing comes out and everyone's like, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And but, you know, he's not really even engaging with it.
And but would it be better if he wasn't? But I guess they kind of were in the beginning. But yeah, are you saying like it would be more interesting if it were?
Not more interesting. It's just that, like, you know, within an authoritarian system, there at some point, you know, even the ones that are more organized than his, they have to allow some of that.
Yeah.
To keep the left disillusioned. Like if you shut down everything, then you have, you know, Mao.
Right.
You know, he's doing it very selectively, but he also knows that he's up against a lot more people and that he can't just go shooting everybody.
Hmm.
Don't just, well, not yet. They're still at Mexicans. Ugh. Yeah, but eventually. But I do think that, you know, culturally, in order for America to exist in the illusion that there is some sort of two-sidedness, that stuff is tolerated.
That's interesting. Like, you have to keep... You have to like
keep the illusion going.
You have to water like the opposing plant.
Right. That's right.
Terrible metaphor. And I don't know what.
But that's an articulation of control as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But like, because like from what I understand about the Maoist revolution, I mean, that was, you know, you're going down, dude. Everyone gets on board, or you're going to go to the camp, or you're going to get killed.
God. It's
we're not there yet.
But I mean, there was like. There was like a ripple of that like went through my body, like when we were just like getting off at the train station. There's like a giant mouse. I was just like, okay, well, like, is this a? I don't know. I thought
like in the first Trump term that the analog to that here is just his constant need for attention.
Right.
It's not a sort of a mythological power.
Right.
But you couldn't get out from under him. Because every 5 minutes he's saying something, and it's like on your phone.
Totally.
And it had the same impact as Stalin or Mao pictures everywhere. It's just like, he's everywhere you look.
And you know what? Mao kept the Hutongs. You know what I mean? He destroyed everything else,
right.
But he kept the Hutongs intact.
Right. He's nostalgic about the Hutongs.
He's nostalgic about the Hutongs. And like, what is SNL if not an American
Hutong?
Cultural Hutong? So wow, you're right. Thank you for assuaging that.
Was that good or bad?
I loved it.
Oh, good. Yeah, I can't say. We'll see. Time will tell.
I don't know. Well, we'll refer back to this.
But what? How do you manage your life now?
Not well, I think. Oh, I mean, compared to shooting Wicked, it's much better. I mean, this past season was a lot, but it was very fun.
And how do you choose other projects?
I don't have a decision making apparatus. I'm just like, oh, am I free? Then great.
Yeah.
Like I'll just take what I can get.
Right. But are you doing bigger parts? Are you finding it challenging, or you feel typecast, or you know you're there to deliver that bow and magic?
You're talking about SNL or just in general?
No, I'm talking about other movies and things.
I don't know. I wouldn't mind just like doing the thing that I've been doing. I don't want to play like a sidekick anymore necessarily.
Right.
So it's a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm just lucky.
Yeah.
I'm not one of those people who has to like constantly push it forward.
Yeah.
I think like I'm okay just kind of like parking it somewhere and just being like, this is good. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I've been parked for 16 years.
And isn't it great?
Yeah, it is. You know, but but for me, like, I'm finding that, like, there are some things creatively that, you know, when you focus on the one thing and you're a creative person and then you become sort of good at that and proficient, you know, there are things in my life that I'm like, well, I want to continue to take risks to feel that, you know, to fulfill that other part of my, you know, desire to do something.
Yeah.
Know, like music or whatever. I'm not saying I'm going to make records or anything, but there is, you know, there's still a rounding off of, I think, the broad spectrum of my creativity that I'd like to do. Like, I'd like to figure out how to play characters, like you guys that are able to slip into characters. It's like,
but in what context? Like a sketch show? Or you just mean like for like other movies,
certain
and TV?
Things that I'm too self-conscious to do. One of them was singing and playing.
And you've done it?
Yeah, I've been doing it.
Yep.
And the other is like, you know, immersing in like a wacky character.
That's fun. I mean, but...
Yeah, but it's too scary because like the nervousness of occupying it and then not getting laughs, I don't know if I could handle it. Because there's always part of me that's sort of like, hey, it's me, man. I can do the other thing. I can do me. Yeah. Because I didn't come up in sketch, and I never did that.
Was Glow your first big acting thing?
After Marin, yeah.
After Marin, yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah, of course. Sorry.
Yeah, but that was me learning how to do it.
Right.
Yeah, Glow was. But like for me, a character just means like, well, this guy's not neurotic, so turn that off, you know, and, and sort of occupy this other part. Like I do have a pretty big menu of male actions.
It's great.
Yeah.
I think there's nothing wrong with, I think my menu of gay male actions is a nice buffet. It's like, I'm happy at the buffet. I don't have to go to another place.
Yeah.
That's just how I don't know. Maybe that's the totally wrong instinct to have, and I should be wanting more for myself, but
yeah, no, but I mean, it'll come when you want it. Sure. I mean, you don't have to want it now.
No, you're right.
And sometimes the opportunity will reveal itself and you'll be like, oh, that's scary. Maybe I should do that.
That's great. My only thing about SNL, at least, is that I'm like, I can feel, and this is not, I don't want you to like push back on this necessarily, or like this is not fishing for anything. I'm just like, I can feel the audience getting sick of me. I can feel things just kind of like turning.
You want me to push back on your cry for help?
Yeah. Is that what this is? Shit. Oh no. I can just tell. I'm like, and like you, I used to be someone who was like always going for the laugh, always desperate for it. And if it didn't happen, it was devastating. And I feel like what the great thing that SNL has done for me is just, it's kind of inoculated me from wanting it all the time.
I did that in stand-up where like I intentionally learned how to sit in the silence because I think that's impactful.
Yeah.
And that it doesn't mean it's not funny. It just means it's landing in a different way.
Yeah.
Like the idea of constantly going for laughs is, and I did it in this special, like there's literally a section where after I lay out the politics with no hope in sight, I'm like, well, I can be entertaining. I don't think that's why I got into this, but I can do it. And I just laid into that. And I'm really on this weird precipice of like, why don't you just be funny? Be more funny. Like, because I feel like I have a social responsibility to kind of go deep in myself and then also lay out my political positions. Mm-hmm. But I know how to be funny. But it's actually more work.
It's so much more work.
And I haven't admitted that to anybody. It's like, it's easier to, you know, kind of, you know, be philosophical and provocative because you're not expecting the same kind of laughs. And then when you don't get them, you're like, well, that's because it's, you know, it's a little much for them to take in. But to just really focus on like being just laugh per minute funny, that's a job, dude.
That's, you're so right. Because being philosophical is the like the diametric opposite of like what other let's say comics do like
right
where they're like they say like a crazy shocking thing
to get the horrible laugh that requires them to work a little
huge
and when that works you're like yes and then that's like because then you know you kind of blew a mind a little bit.
I love that.
Yeah. But, you know, the kind of like just goofier shit, which you can load up pretty good. And, and you can turn phrases that'll do the same thing. But to really like tell a story or do a run of jokes that are just laugh, you know, kind of maximized.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a pretty great feeling, too.
Yeah.
But you realize, like, God, it'd be a whole hour of that. Is that really what I'm supposed to be doing?
And the work, and then that's the work, and that's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really nice, Mark. I feel like you're also clarifying for me that I might be going about this the wrong way at SNL, where it's just about like, it's just about what's immediately gratifying to both the audience and to you as a writer, because you're just like, okay, like we've only got 2 days to do this. Yeah. Let's just like load her up with like quick little jokes.
Yeah.
I can tell you, breaking news, I never want to play a fucking inanimate object ever again. I never want to, like, I don't want to really go for like the low hanging, like gay male fruit.
Yeah.
But it's kind of what, like, sometimes I don't want to blame anybody, but it feels like it's what people sort of like internally want me to do.
Yeah.
And I try to push back on it as much as I can. And if you go and find the weird stuff that's like a little more out there and like a little bit more risky, or risk taking, I should say, like, it's there. It's just like, it, I guess it just doesn't get the same kind of like response.
Well, how does Lauren react to it?
I think Lauren just wants it to be a good show for everybody, no matter what. Every episode, he really wants it to just be the best show. He's like that kind of impresario person. He's just
it's interesting, kind of the techniques. And it does it does seem like it would be pressure to be the gay cast member.
And I want there to be others.
Yeah.
You know? And there have been. I just like other gay men would be so fun.
But I think, like, you know, when you think about like Hader or something, that, you know, the other techniques to comedically, like, there's, you know, like to figure out how to do slow burn stuff. You know, like I guess it's just an applied, you know, like to see a different timing to how you want to present something.
Yeah.
To at least, you know, challenge that part of yourself.
I know. And I have it really good there, you know? I just think it's still a huge cast.
Yeah.
And there's just none of us can afford to like go for the slow burn stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, I'm only in two things this week, and I gotta make them count.
And there's like 10 that aren't gonna be on.
Exactly.
And, you know, 4 performers that aren't gonna be on this week.
So
there's a moment where it's sort of like, well, they'll just throw that in there.
Right.
And like, this is going to, you know, I'm in now.
Right.
Yeah.
There's only so many minutes in the show.
Sure. Yeah.
On top of there being this many cast members, and on top of there it being like, okay, well, how do you get everyone to score? And it's just all of these things.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I think like working there is, I don't know. Well, okay.
Yeah.
Being back on the 8th floor this week, like, did that, was there a regressive
pull? No.
Okay, great.
No, because like, I loved doing Conan.
Yeah.
And you know, whatever evolved between me and Conan, the thing I realized, I think I talked about it on that opening you listened to, is like, I was always trying to do well.
Yeah.
It's just like, people didn't know me and I was a lot. So when I come out with, you know, hot, people are like, who the fuck is this guy? So like, I can forgive that. I don't have any of that going back.
That's
there.
That's great.
I'm always happy to be on that floor and to, you know, and I love Seth. I mean, Seth is great.
The best. But I was even asking, like, being on that floor and like having like the SNL doors be right there. Like,
No. I mean, like, you know, that was like, you know, 3 days of my life. I don't care. Did I even audition in the studio? I didn't think I did, because I wasn't a character guy. I think I was being, if anything, looked at for update.
For update.
Yeah. So like, I didn't have to go through that.
Sure.
Like, I didn't go through the whole sort of like, you know, on stage doing character thing.
Bless.
I just had the meeting with Lorne.
Great.
But like, I can't even remember really that office until I was back in it. Like that, that wasn't the trauma. The trauma was like, you know, how did I fuck this up?
Right.
And
you're the candy guy.
Yeah.
I was looking for that in my meeting. I was
he swears it was Tootsie Rolls, and I gotta believe him.
It might have been Tootsie Rolls.
Yeah,
your meeting went better than mine the first year, because I auditioned enough times. The first meeting I took with him totally bombed. Didn't get it.
Yeah,
and it was because I came.
Were
in
you
hot.
Already writing there?
No. So there was one whole year between. I auditioned 4 times total.
Yeah.
And 2 times the first year in 2017, made it to the Lorne meeting. And the first thing out of my mouth, I came in hot, and he was like, who the fuck is this guy? I was like, but by the way, I'm Canadian too, and I speak French fluently.
Oh, right,
and I grew up in Montreal, and oh my God. And he was like, what? And and didn't get the job. And they just called me back in a year later. And then by then it was fine. But it was just like, I felt this spiritual connection to you after I fucked up that meeting. So, so hard.
Well, I mean, when I was there, it was like, it was Lorne, and then Higgins came in, and he's like looming over Lorne. It was like the fucking Godfather. And they're just both looking at me like, am I supposed to be exuding something? What am I, you know? And I was cocky, and I don't feel any real trauma about that shit anymore.
I love that.
Well, I think by virtue of realizing that I was not ready to do it. I never thought in terms of a career in show business or how to get a job. Mm-hmm. I was just a fucking, you know, monster. It was just a comic, you know? And so there was nothing calculating in my head. Uh-huh. Like, I had no angle.
Yeah.
You know, I was just sort of like, this is me, man. What do we, you know?
Yeah.
Whatever.
Whatever. Okay, good. I was asking, like, being back on AO. Okay, so no, that was not regressive in terms of the SNL piece.
No.
Great.
But also talking to Lorne, I mean, and him giving me 2 days. Uh-huh. That was the funniest part about it. It's like, you know, he had to be somewhere, and we did like an hour or so, and he's like, did you get what you needed, or you need to come back? And I'm like, yeah, I could come back. So, okay. You go. And so,
I love it.
And it really humanized him.
Yeah.
You know, just an appendage of that floor. And he's been walking those hallways for like 40 fucking years. You know, and he's a TV producer.
Yeah.
And like, and he lives there. Okay, fine. He's got $1 billion in the house in the Hamptons, wherever the hell it is. But day to day,
He's never missed a show, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. He's just the guy who works at that place and runs that shop. Mm-hmm. It's weird. Maybe I'm
it's weird, but it's also no. And I trust me, I'm someone who's like, Lorne, you goof, but I think about it and I'm like, oh, it's also incredible. And whatever. It's everything.
So what is this award show MC signs for?
Oh, Matt, my friend Matt Rogers and I have a podcast.
Yeah,
years. He was the gay guy in the sketch group at NYU. I was the gay guy in the improv group, and then we became friends. We did sketch together after school, after college, I should say.
Yeah,
and then started this podcast. Didn't think it would go anywhere, and then it's been like the most consistent thing. And then we did a bit a few years ago where we just like had no guest on, and we were just kind of like unveiled a list of 100 categories and like 10 nominees in each one.
Yeah.
And then we were like, okay, well, we'll announce the winners at a later date, and just no plans to like actually produce anything, or make anything out of it. And then we did it at Lincoln Center 1 year, because we got an offer to do a slot there. We were like, what should we do? Oh, we can like pretend the awards are a thing.
Yeah.
And then we just did that over, this is our fourth year doing it overall, but our first time doing it on TV. And so, yeah, it's just been a
made up award show.
Made up award show. That's all it is.
Yeah. And I guess the last question is there, because one of the surprise kind of results of me doing WTF was that it really was helpful to a lot of people. Is there a gay Asian contingent of your audience that is grateful to you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I feel like I'm really lucky in that gay Asian contingent does reach out.
Yeah.
Every now and then, and it's that is really that's
and
crazy.
They see representation.
Yeah, I think the touching thing about the China social media moment was that they were like, "Wow, like, kind of crazy that like this guy like is on a show like SNL." Yeah. Like, that's pretty wild, because like. Like there would be a lot of breakdown videos where people would be like, okay, here's who this guy is, and here's what he's known for. And then one of the things was SNL, and they were like, you know, SNL has always been this wonderful sort of cross section of American comedy and different people from different walks of life coming and just different comedy disciplines arriving in it at different moments. And like, they were just like, you know, this is a guy who came up in his own weird way. And I think the definitive thing about SNL now is that it is a very, to Lauren's credit, it's a very great cross section of comedy today.
Yeah,
where you have club people, you have old people, you have sketch people, you have Groundlings UCB people, but you also have like TikTok comedians. You have like there's no discriminating thing there.
Right. He knows how wide open the field is.
Exactly.
And he's taking advantage of that.
I think so. Somehow we all work well together.
That's good. And the reconciliation with Shane, was that real?
What are you talking about? Like the hug?
Well, I mean, was that because they made a lot of hay out of that.
They did.
And, I just wonder what the real feelings were.
The real feelings are, I think, we have nothing in common, but I think there's a mutual sort of respect from afar. I think
he's a funny guy.
I think the trauma that I was talking about in terms of being moved to cast was I think I'm still dealing with being implicated in some way in this one of these big national stories about cancel culture.
Yeah.
I think I'm still working through that.
Yeah, because you didn't volunteer for that.
No, and neither did. And what I think is important is that he and I had in that weekend a moment of connection just to be like, hey, are you okay?
Yeah.
Because this is crazy.
What you mean when it happened?
When it happened.
Yeah.
When
he was in the building.
So I don't think we were in the building at the same time, but it was announced on that day, and then
that he had gotten fired or got caught.
That the three of us, that me, Chloe, and Shane were hired, and then I got up early, I went to the park, meditated, and then I was like, okay, my whole life's about to change. Celebratory moment, and then I took a nap, and then when I got up, we had the same agent.
Yeah.
So when I got up, my agent calls me, and she's like, I'm so sorry. And I missed all these, I had all these missed calls. She was like, I'm so sorry. I was like, what are you talking about? Then I find out about it, and then my first instinct is, the first thing I tell my agent is, do you have his number? I need to call him.
Yeah.
I just need to check in and see where he is.
Yeah.
So the there was no reconciliation.
Had you met him before or no?
We'd not met before.
Oh.
And so the reconciliation is that what happened on that day that it all broke. It was just hey, we're two human beings. I don't know, I don't know you from Adam. I don't know your comedy from anywhere. And I think he could say the same for me. It was just I think these are human beings at the center
of this.
And
what was the conversation?
So he did not get back to me until 2 days later.
Yeah.
And speaking of Awkwafina, I was on set for the show for Nora. And then, ironically, I was on a set with a bunch of other Asian people. It was just this thing of everything about that moment was so weird and kismety, and it all broke in this way. The reason it resonated was because of the irony of the coincidence of the hirings, So the conversation later was he called me back and he was like, hey, this is crazy. How are you doing? I'm so sorry. Blah, blah, blah.
It wasn't I was just joking.
No way. I have no idea what I still have no idea what those days were like for him.
Yeah.
But then I was like, hey, look, we can make it work.
Yeah.
It's whatever. I'm here for you, ? And then I said, and I'll see you at work.
Yeah.
This is before they announced the firing. Sure. And I was like, I'll see you at work. And then I think at that point he knew something that I did, and he kind of laughed and said, yeah, sure. And then we hung up. Because I think at that point he had been told that he was not going to work.
Yeah, anymore. Yeah.
And so the fact that he's been back multiple times is that's there was just nothing to reconcile. But I think both of us have had to navigate
being used.
Being used.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there was a recruitment going on either side of if you like this guy, then this is what you stand for.
Right.
And if you like this guy, then this is what you stand for. And I think both of us are probably a little bit more dimensional than that.
Yeah, totally. Usually is the case. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was great talking to you, pal.
You too. Sorry if I was long-winded.
No, you're not.
Okay.
Did you feel good about it?
I feel great about it.
Good. There you go. What a great talk. What a great guy. He's up for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series at the Emmys. And hang out for a minute, folks. Hey, next Monday, my guest will be Ben Stiller. And if you have a WTF Plus subscription, you can go all the way back to episode 79. That was the first time I talked to Ben on the show. It was a big deal. And this was back in 2010. Tropic Thunder, I think, is one of the best Hollywood satires ever.
Oh, thanks.
And I had to watch it a couple of times to really see that there are some jokes and there's some nuances in there that are going to be lost on a lot of people.
Right, right.
But nonetheless, you know, you really took on the monster that feeds you.
Right. Yeah, for sure. But I mean, that never was an issue for me. Like that to take it to me, that's actually where I've always gravitated.
I know. And Ben Stiller Show did that as well.
That's always where I've found you know, that's the humor that I've enjoyed is the, you know, where you are able to make fun of this ridiculous world. And how caught up we all get in it and be able to look at, you know, ourselves and see.
But
that,
I thought that thing did it in such a way, like I didn't feel like, obviously, you know, a threat to the industry is decided that's decided upon whether or not it makes a lot of money.
Right.
So on some level, you know, you were protected there because the movie did well.
It did well enough. Yeah. The you know, when you really when you break it down, I think the real chance that was taken was by the studio to make a movie that was that. You know, that big
critical
budget of movie that was about a subject matter that historically has not really ever been successful at the box office.
When they decided that, was their decision based primarily on, you know, you being in it and Jack being in it and Downey? I mean, were they like, well, how can we lose?
I think, no, you know, I honestly think it was a unique situation at a studio, DreamWorks, that it was not, has changed in the last couple of years since then. I think it was a moment in time. I don't think that movie could get made today at that budget,
right?
Because everything has changed so radically in the last couple of years.
Right. That's episode 79 with Ben Stiller. Get that episode and every WTF episode ad-free with a WTF Plus subscription. Just go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. This guitar bit here is a little sloppy, but I do think I landed on some kind of AC/DC-ish riff in the midst of it. All right. So here. Take it.
rumor lives, Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere.